What is our fascination with the red planet, Mars? In a moment, we'll talk with Sir Charles Schulz III about Mars on Coast to Coast AM. Regular guest here at Coast to Coast, Sir Charles Schulz worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapon systems, computer-based automated test equipment as well. He wrote the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing 2 missile system, worked on the Patriot, the Copperhead tank killer, and the advanced attack helicopter systems. Charles has performed research under Grant on nuclear fusion, was knighted, and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence. He has written many technical publications and magazine articles on space astronomy, the atmosphere, and space resource development, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Sir Charles, my friend, how are you?
I'm doing very well, George. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. You bring us interesting things to think about, Sir Charles. You really do. What have you been doing lately?
Well, a lot of my research in the last couple of years has been in green energy and solar power and purification of water. And, of course, everybody has to make a little bread and butter. But, of course, the interest in Mars never waned, and I've finished my book on the subject, The Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars, and I'll go over some of that information as well.
Perfect. When you started looking at some of the anomalies on Mars, what did you look at it with just the computer, and then you blew it up? What gave you the perspective that you had?
Well, a lot of it comes from studying Mars for many years in the past. I think that everybody who knows anything about the solar system has a great interest in the planets, their geology and atmospheres, and how they're the same as our world and how different they are. And so a lot of the background information came from years of previous study. When the information came back, everything that you could download from the Internet was fair game. And, of course, using the computer allows you to download the information and study it in depth. And, of course, there are limits to the resolution of the images, so it's good to have many images and many sources of information to deal with.
There's been a picture floating around the Internet over the last couple weeks about Mars. It looks like a log or a piece of wood. Have you seen that one?
Yes, I have. In fact, that comes from very early on in the mission, around Sol 110 to 120, Opportunity in the area of Endurance Crater. And in fact, it isn't a log at all. It's the edge of one of those sedimentary slabs. As anybody that looks at the images for any period of time knows, those are all sedimentary rock laid
sure.
down underwater.
Okay. What do we find so fascinating with Mars? I mean, I even know, Charles, that when I was a youngster, I mean, I was just obsessed with that planet. More so Venus than more so Saturn, even though Saturn looked great through a telescope. It was Mars that captured my imagination. How come?
Well, it's because Mars is so very much like the Earth. When we look around our solar system, most of the planets are either very, very cold, have thick atmospheres, crushing atmospheres, or they're very hot. And Mars is right in that moderate zone where it's quite likely, as people looked at it, they realized that it could support something that's alive. So it's a place that you can go, and it's a place that you can see, a place that you literally can touch with your mind right now, and very shortly, hopefully, with human astronauts.
Yeah, eventually. I would hope sooner than later. I don't know how many years it's going to take. What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm hearing these figures of 20 to 30 years, and I think that's terribly terribly pessimistic. I believe that if we were to turn this over to the commercial sector, we could get this done in about 10 to 15.
I think you're right. And you know what concerns me, too, is that if we sit on our duff too long, I think another country will attempt to do this.
Well, they're certainly making moves on the moon right now, you know. India, China, and Russia have all expressed great interest in the moon, and both China and Russia are going to be mining it for helium-3 in the very near future.
Well, that's because they're getting smart about alternative energy sources, aren't they?
Absolutely, and there's plenty of energy out there free for the taking. We just need to get up and do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Have you been watching, by the way, what's been going on with the automobile industry in Congress?
Well, I have, and it's a little bit discouraging because there are so many other things we could be doing. And I must admit, gasoline is king. It's very hard to displace because you can put an awful lot of energy in a tank of gas. But there are alternatives, and they are being explored and expanded upon right now.
We've got to get you back for an energy show in the future.
We'd certainly be glad to.
Now, when I look at Mars, I look at what Earth could end up like. When I look at Earth, I look at what I think Mars used to be. What do you think?
Well, I agree with you absolutely, because over time, atmosphere and ocean get lost. You know, planets don't have infinite attraction, and the erosion from solar wind and loss from gravity means your air is going away and your oceans are going away. And Mars, being a very small world, just doesn't have enough mass to hold on to its atmosphere and its air. But it also has another problem, and that is it doesn't have a lot of volcanic activity. And on Earth, that's what replaces our oceans and our atmospheres. So on Mars, those things aren't working very well, and they have a very small core, and their air has been lost. But there is another factor involved, and that is the oceans didn't completely vanish on Mars. They actually are still present, but in the form of glaciers in many areas, just under less than an inch of soil, just a centimeter or so of soil.
In terms of the equipment that we have on Mars, that have, I think they've been doing just a phenomenal job, Sir Charles, getting us some data and getting us great pictures. You got to congratulate the folks that have worked on that, huh?
Oh, no doubt. You know, it took a huge amount of effort to create hardware as durable and reliable as those rovers. They were originally specced to only last 90 days, and they've been pushing 5 years now.
You know, the similarities between Earth and Mars, if it would only have held its atmosphere, if it could have kept its water the way we have ours, you know, it probably could have fostered life. We'll get into that with you a little bit later on. And then later on tonight, Richard C. Hoagland will join us for a bit to chat with you, too. I want to just see the two titans of Mars chat about this thing, this incredible planet. But what do you think happened to Mars, assuming it had these oceans, it had an atmosphere, whether it had life or not, we'll get into that. But what do you think happened to the planet? Why did it all dissipate or sink into the ground?
Well, of course, the number one issue is it's a very small world, and it doesn't have a great deal of gravity. There's only about 38% as much gravitational pull on its surface, so it can't hold on to its atmosphere. It's constantly leaking off into space like an airbag with a puncture in it. And over the course of time, as the atmosphere gets thinner, the boiling point of water goes down, and it's harder to keep water in a liquid form. But one of the biggest contributors to its loss, other than its small size, is that Mars does not have a large moon, as the Earth does. Now, if you've ever watched a top spin, it begins to wobble as it spins down. Well, planets wobble as well on their axis.
Sure.
And for our world, we have a moon, a very large, massive moon, that keeps our axis more or less stable. It dampens out those vibrations or oscillations. Mars, unfortunately, doesn't have a massive moon, and so as a result, its axis tumbles a lot, and its seasons can vary wildly in the space of 50,000 years.
Do you think that when Mars formed, and then when it got its ocean-type waters, it then almost immediately started losing them at the same time?
Oh, absolutely right. In fact, both of the planets, Earth and Mars, apparently had around 250 to 300 atmospheres of pressure when they were first formed and molten. So you can imagine how much air had to have been lost over the many billions of years in order for it to reach the present-day state that we see it in.
Is that happening to us now, too?
Well, yes, it is. It has been all along. In fact, if you look at the fossil record on Earth, you'll see many gigantic creatures such as two-foot cockroaches and dragonflies and giant insects. And people wonder how in the world such things could possibly have existed. Well, the answer is very simple. We had nearly twice as much atmosphere back during the Permian era on our planet, and that air has been lost over the last 360 to 400 million years.
You're still looking for new discoveries. Tell me how and why.
Well, all the time. You never stop looking once you've made a discovery. The most prominent method of doing the research is to download all the new images and continue to go over them. And if you can find three or four shots of the same place from a different angle or from different imagers, you can get much better resolution than a single monochrome image, the little black and white pictures you see. And the reason why is very simple. Once you recognize something like this, you know you're onto something of major importance, and it's something that people need to know about. It expresses a lot about our past, not just the past of Mars, but it also tells us one other thing. When we look around the universe in times to come and we begin exploring planets around other stars, we're going to find a lot of them are probably a lot more like Mars than like Earth. And so Mars gives us the key to understanding, perhaps, many of the worlds we're going to find in other solar systems in the future.
Now, of course, this recent discovery that there are glaciers on Mars, what's the significance of that?
Well, there are two significant factors, and one is they knew this many years ago, actually. But one of the most significant things is, with the addition of a little bit of heat, that water could return. But imagine this as well. Since we know that those glaciers are there, they had to be formed with huge ocean-sized bodies of water. So that's one of the very strong indicators that that water was in a liquid form not long ago. And if you look at the cratering, the amount of craters on a given area or surface of the planet,
right,
you can tell, you can date it, just like an archaeologist would date something. You can tell how long that water has been there. Well, the glacier field on the equator of Mars is less than 5 million years old. And that means that 5 million years ago, not 5 billion years ago, or 3 billion, which is the typical figure quoted by NASA, 5 million years ago or less, there had to be an ocean on the planet. And that's, you know, just a drop in the bucket as far as this, the flow of time goes.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's nothing in the scheme of things. And then, what created that dissipation? And you just think the loss of the atmosphere caused the water to evaporate?
Well, actually, it didn't all evaporate, of course, as you know, that it's there in the form of glaciers. But what
right.
has happened is the planet is in an ice age, and it's been a long-term ice. There's very little on Mars to keep its temperature up as we have on Earth. Now, Mars is a very dark planet. It absorbs about 85% of the sunlight falling on it. The Earth only absorbs about 62-63% of the sunlight falling on it. We reflect a lot of heat back to space. But its changing climate over time and its loss of atmosphere has made it tougher to stay warm. And the only thing keeping the planet very warm now is that the greenhouse effect from its mostly carbon dioxide atmosphere is heating the planet about 20 degrees C warmer than it would otherwise be.
Take me through the stages of a glacier forming.
Well, in essence, on an ocean, as the temperatures drop and icebergs form, they will eventually start covering the surface of that ocean, and it will drive out all the salt lower and lower in level. And eventually, as the ocean freezes solid and all of its organisms, if any, are present, and all of its salts and minerals are forced to the bottom layers of the ice, eventually you end up with a smooth, flat surface. And over time, the wind sculpts and erodes it down until it's just about as flat as it can be. Now, on Mars, there's a lot of orange, rust-colored dust, and that dust and soil gets blown around the planet during the dust storms. Eventually, that dust covers those glaciers, and you end up with huge fractured areas that have these cracks in them that are very characteristic and easy to recognize. So over the course of a couple of million years, you can freeze an ocean very easily, and you end up with these glacier fields. They get covered with dust, and then the meteors hit them, and we have an indicator of their age.
How tall do you think these glaciers could be?
Well, some of them are actually estimated to be as much as a half a mile or more in thickness. There are some deposits of ice that we see in some craters that represent enough water to give everyone on Earth plenty. We would never run out on Mars if we were to go and just start warming up the soil and the glaciers that we find. But there's enough water, if you were to melt just the polar caps, to cover the planet in something like 15 to 30 meters, depending on whose estimates you listen to. So you could literally bring the planet's oceans back by warming it up right now.
One of the things that you and Richard have in common, you look for fossils. You know, he has, through his enterprisemission.com for years, been looking for fossils on Mars. You do, too. That tells me both of you are convinced that there was some kind of life on Mars.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind for a number of reasons, but the finding of these fossils and the odd artifacts in the picture that I submitted, for instance, and that I have on my website,
yes,
are very key pieces of evidence. And many of these things are difficult for people to see, but many of them are also very obvious.
Do you think NASA knows if they're that obvious?
In my mind, there's no doubt at all. In fact, the issue has been brought to their attention, and they've visited my website many times. And the issue is very strange because many people in the past have resort to something known as the Brookings Report to explain
yes.
why NASA won't talk about alien life. And, of course, the Brookings Report is not very recent. It's been around for many ages. It basically was an assessment of society, and the basic statement was, if we were to release information that alien life existed, it could cause religious repercussions that would, you know, cause a great deal of problems in the world. The recent version of the Brookings Report is called the NASA Societal Report, and in this they confront the same issue, and they come to the conclusion that they need to have a plan in place to handle the societal reaction to an announcement of the existence of alien life. But then they gloss over it quite a bit. And now realize in the Brookings Report, nobody recommended one way or the other what should be done. They didn't say the government should hide it. They simply said, we recommend basically that you be aware of the reactions that could exist.
Right.
In the
right.
societal report, which was just produced in 1999, they actually went so far as saying we need to put a plan in place and not really push this information until we know how to handle it and how people are going to handle it. Personally, I don't feel there's going to be any real repercussion because most people are reasonable enough to know that facts are what counts, not belief.
But what are we talking about, though, Charles? Because I thought when the Brookings came out in 60 that talked about, alien life, I think their assumption was ET-type life. I mean, little grays or something like that. And that's what I think they felt people could not handle. Do you think that's what they had in mind, or are we talking about little microbes?
Well, in a word, they were thinking about big walking around talking technological aliens back in
yes.
the Brookings report. That was the,
yes.
that was the implied finding. And nobody really discussed whether or not finding microbes or worms or seashells would be anything of a big issue. However, when we really get down to the issue, any living organism that's not on the Earth is an alien organism if it's not sharing our genetic code or our origins. And people aren't going to be so upset about it. But the long-term implications are what is important. Because if we find that a rather inhospitable place such as Mars had a rich biosphere with all these fossils left afterwards, then what can we say about other worlds? People don't survive a meeting very easily with a more technically advanced civilization. And by definition, since we don't have the ability to go to the stars just now, if we meet intelligent aliens, they must have the ability to get here from a very great distance, and that implies a high technological level of development.
I think so, too. And you see, I think people have been so desensitized now. Programs like this, Charles, movies, exposure everywhere. I think most people expect ET life to exist.
Well, absolutely. I think I have to agree with you on that, because half of every movie we see, half of every fiction we hear, is based on the assumption that there's somebody out there.
Tell me about the fossils that you believe existed on Mars.
Well, basically, they're marine remains. And when you think about it, simple organisms live in our oceans that are pretty universal, such as sea urchins and clams and very, very simple things. And if you have an ocean on any planet, you would expect similar forms to evolve. And the discovery I made was actually quite by accident, but I find that earlier researchers also found what appeared to be evidence of marine fossils in the past. Now, what I have found is basically the remains of organisms that look like sea urchins. We found some shark's teeth. We find seashells. But everything, again, is of a marine nature. And on Mars, the air was very thin. The oceans would function as a surrogate atmosphere so that anything in the ocean could get dissolved gases and would have enough protection from the ultraviolet and the environment around them. So it's just basically marine fossils, nothing exciting to most people who are looking for aliens.
Do you think Mars at one time, though, was a lush planet? It had trees and shrubs and grass and everything like that?
Well, any biosystem has to have the ability to gather basic energy. So you have to have plants, you have to have diatoms, you have to have bacteria. These forms would be present in any biosphere if you're supporting animal organisms, and by all accounts that I can see, they were supporting animal life. As to how lush the planet is, that's debatable. We really don't have enough information at this point because we haven't explored a lot of the areas in great detail. And imagine what a planet looks like when you remove most of its atmosphere and all of its surface water for any significant period of time, such as 5 or 10 million years. It's going to destroy a lot of signs that would have been left behind otherwise. Just imagine the Earth being done in that manner, and imagine what you'd find on the surface. Not much.
The deserts in Africa, the deserts in the Middle East, they were lush at one time, and they look Mars-like now.
Well, absolutely right, and that's one of the points. If you remove surface water, though, even though the surface becomes very much like a desert, you still have artesian springs, you have glaciers, you have wells from underground, and you have a water table. And those things don't go away very easily, and they're still present on Mars as well, in my estimation.
All right, well, stay with us, Sir Charles Schultz. His website, xenotechresearch.com, all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, Sir Charles Schulz, will be joined later by Richard C. Hoagland, and Sir Charles then will be with us for phone calls in the final hour. Have you subscribed yet to the After Dark magazine? Well, if not, do so, or when you renew, you'll get two CDs, Art Bell Interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin, when you call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coast2coastam.com. And back with Sir Charles Schulz. Sir Charles, do you think there's anything alive on the planet today?
Well, I don't doubt that at the very least there will be bacterial and fungal organisms still alive. And I think that that was indicated by the Viking results back in 1976 when they did the labeled release experiment. They found what clearly looked like biology in the soil at that time.
Well, but anything more significant, do you think? I mean, little worms in the ground or anything?
Well, it's very much possible. Imagine every time we look in the most extreme environments on our planet, we seem to find unknown organisms by the dozens. So in my estimation, yes, there's got to be more than just bacteria. And also consider that many things on our Earth, such as brine shrimp or water bears or other organisms, can go into hibernation literally for a century or more. And then with the addition of water, they come right back to life as if nothing happened. So I would not be very surprised to discover that there were many things living on the surface. And with the addition of a little water and heat, they would come back.
Brine shrimp, I think that's what we had as kids. You'd buy these little packs, right? And you'd
exactly,
dump them in the water,
yeah.
And they'd come alive.
You drop a little dust-looking material. It's really their eggs and some water. And within a couple of hours, you've got brine shrimp swimming around. So imagine if the organisms on Mars had the same sort of adaptation. They could be in hibernation for centuries. And then as soon as the little water comes back, it wouldn't take but one out of a million of them to survive a couple of centuries of hibernation, and the species would be back in action again.
You know, I have always thought that the primordial soup is the same all throughout the universe, Sir Charles. You know, it's just a matter of conditions on a planet. You know, is it warm enough? Does it have enough water? But I think the soup is the same. It's everywhere. So Mars has got to have, or at least had, some kind of life. And I think other planets probably do too. You know, Europa might have had it.
Well,
maybe still does.
That's a good point. You know, the same chemicals exist all throughout the universe, and the laws of chemistry and physics are universal. So anywhere that you've got a little ultraviolet light or a little lightning, and you have carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, and those are everywhere, you're going to find the primordial soup. It forms automatically. And the material actually has a name. It's called tholin, T-H-O-L-I-N. And it's very easy to produce. And, in fact, I've got to mention the book on how to make your own tholin if you'd like to try it out.
Please, go ahead.
Well, basically, all you need is a source of water, some ammonia, some carbon of some sort, such as methane, and a lightning discharge, or a neon transformer, for instance. And I go through the steps on how to do it. Very simple. You seal up a container, you put the materials in, and you run the electric current. And when this was done originally, it was called the Uri Miller experiment. And what they found was it generated amino acids, it generated sugars, alcohols, and a lot of other biological materials from non-biological or abiotic materials. And anybody can do it, really. It's very simple.
What about other anomalies that might be on the planet?
Well, I've got a page I sent to you that has a picture, and it shows a number of objects that certainly are more than rocks. One of the things that stands out to people is geometric shapes, and we've got one object that is a perfect pentagon with a hole in the center, and it's hollow. That's a little hard to explain from a rock standpoint. Another one looks like a curled object, very hard to describe unless you see the image. But there are many objects shaped like a rind. Imagine taking a seed pod and pulling the rind off of it,
right,
or cutting an avocado in sections and pulling the seed out of the middle. Well, these things are all over the planet, and I found a couple of dozen of them after going through the images. And it appears that what these are the segments of something known as a blastoid. We had an organism that lived in our seas many years ago. They're now extinct, but they're related to sea lilies or crinoids. And these organisms left their remains apparently all over the planet. And I've got a number of those pictured, some in color, some in stereo, on the site, and even in animation on YouTube that some people can find. But it doesn't surprise me that these things have been passed up by the rovers, because the imaging teams, when testing the hardware, drove the rovers through the petrified forest and were unable to recognize petrified wood with it. Not only that, the Viking teams, when they were testing their imagers, had an incident where a fellow placed a trilobite fossil in the field, and when the imager ran over the trilobite fossil and produced the picture, people talked themselves out of believing what they saw. And when they did a news press conference, because they even practiced those when they were getting ready for the mission, somebody jokingly said, well, it looks like we found life on Mars, and they became very upset about that. So there appears to be an internal bias against finding life within NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab, and it's very odd because these are the people we're counting on to make these discoveries for us, and it appears they failed miserably.
Well, how long do you think some of these anomalies have been on the planet?
It could be 10 years, could be 10,000 years. It's very hard to say because in the course of events, fossils will erode out of a rock, drop to the surface perhaps, and lay there on the surface until somebody comes along and finds it. And in some cases, if you just turn the dirt over with a shovel, you can find things very easily as well. And we really don't have that option with the existing rovers because they don't have shovels or grabbers or manipulators of any sort. So it's only by the greatest chance if you run over a slab of rock and it tips and it brings something up to the surface that you'll spot some of these items. But many of them are in beautiful shape. Some of them have wonderful patterns on them that are easy to see.
What about these so-called glass tubes that are on the planet?
You know, I had a look at those, and I've discovered exactly what those are. And again, this is my opinion, but looking at the photos and working with a device called a Kunsttube, I've discovered a very easy explanation for these. There used to be an exhibit in many of the science centers or museums that had a long plastic tube that was clear, and they would put sand or styrofoam beads inside the tube, and they'd have a speaker at one end. And when you turn the speaker on, you run the frequency up and down, and it creates little bars all the way down the tube, little mounds of the sand or the styrofoam. And the spacing of these mounds depends on the wavelength. Now imagine you have a long, narrow gully on Mars, and the wind is whipping down that gully, and it's resonating. We've all heard the wind whistle when it passes through a certain portion of a building or past a certain canyon. Imagine miles-long undisturbed canyons on Mars with the wind whistling through them, and that resonating, whistling wind creating standing sand dunes at regular intervals. And when you look at the pictures with that in mind, you can see that, yes, indeed, these are sand dunes.
So you and Richard will chat a little bit next hour, Sir Charles. Different views, similar views. It's going to be fascinating just to see your take on some of his things and his on yours. But, you know, he's a believer in the face on Mars. I don't think you are. Are you?
No, actually, it appears to me that the cause of the face and the pyramid forms in that region is very simple. Again, we know that there are glaciers under the soil. If you end up with a crack in a glacier, it tends to create a long linear zone in it or a line-shaped crack as the water melts or evaporates away. And the soil deposited on top of that glacier will slide down the side like sand in an hourglass to the angle of repose, as it's called. Well, if you have blocks of ice under the soil eroding away, the soil is going to slide down on the sides and create slope sides all around it. And there's a very natural way of producing the shape of the face, the pyramids, and other forms that we see.
So you think the pyramids, those objects that look like pyramids, again, are natural formations?
I do believe they're natural formations caused by the existence of glaciers just under the soil.
What about the machine parts or gears?
You know, that's a very good one. And many of those were brought to my attention a while back when I was doing this research. Many of those odd items were very difficult to classify until I realized what I was looking at. Those strange geared or toothed wheels that we find are seashells. They have exact analogs on Earth that look very much like machine parts. If you see them from the wrong angle, you'd mistake it for a piece of a machine very easily. And, of course, that's another issue we address both on my website and in the book. We talk about all the different forms marine life has and how some of them can fool you into believing some very odd or strange things.
Okay, so this leads us up to intelligent life on Mars or not. I, based on what you're saying, I don't think you will tell us that you believe that there had been intelligent life on that planet.
In my opinion, anything native to Mars is probably not much smarter than a shark or a squid. I don't think that any intelligent life evolved on the planet, at least at this point, and I have to qualify it, I have not seen any evidence that convinces me anything smarter than a small animal would have ever been existing on the planet.
But you're open to the possibilities.
Oh, I'm open to possibilities. I know that there is intelligent life in the universe. There must be. When you consider that in our galaxy alone, there are over 400 billion stars. And so far, just about every star we've examined tends to show planets. So somewhere out in those hundreds of billions of worlds that we're going to find over the coming years, there has to be something alive and there has to be something intelligent.
Why hasn't NASA admitted to the possibility of the existence of this possible alien life?
Well, number one, you know, they have to be very careful and very circumspect about what they do announce, because it's bad for an organization to look foolish. So I can understand a little reluctance to say things about life forms on another planet. But number two, imagine for a moment that they admitted that there was something intelligent out there and it wasn't necessarily friendly, it was an unknown. Well, it could cause a panic in some people's minds, and they wouldn't want to know that there is something out there that is more capable and perhaps more intelligent than we are. And a lot of people base a lot of what they believe on religious ideas.
Sure.
And
absolutely.
So many of them will reject outright any thought that there could be something as intelligent as a person building machinery or doing anything like composing symphonies or making buildings. And, you know, people have to stop and think. If you have aliens living on a planet that are intelligent like human beings, they're going to have the same needs and problems we have. They'll have farming and schools. They'll have factories. They'll have the same sorts of things that we do. So in an example that many of us have encountered in the past, historically, when a technically advanced civilization comes in contact with a lesser advanced civilization, the lesser advanced civilization almost always gets wiped out or suffers badly. And people don't want to see that happen.
But, you know, the Vatican came out several months ago with a statement that the belief in extraterrestrial life does not hurt or negate the belief in a god or God, which
well,
I think was a pretty dramatic statement.
The Vatican seems a bit more progressive than NASA in that statement.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Who would have ever thought?
You know, to me, it sounds, and you know what? They've got their own observatories, and to me, that they are far ahead in the search for extraterrestrial life than NASA is. Or if NASA doesn't admit it, they may be doing something in some kind of black ops program somewhere. You never know.
Well, you know, it's an issue that we all will have to confront eventually, and a lot of people don't like to confront the issues. It's easier for them to go through their workaday existence. But, you know, we have found fossils, in my opinion, and I think a lot of people will be convinced when they see what's here. And it's just a matter of time, again. We're going to find living organisms, and eventually we're going to find intelligence.
Do you believe these fossils that are on Mars would also echo the same kind of creatures we've got on this planet?
Well, you know,
many people object
to that, and I believe that they do, and here's why. Many times people have said, well, alien life would be entirely different from what we have on Earth. It would follow a completely different evolutionary path. But here's the error in that argument. Organisms are shaped by the jobs they have to do to survive. They're shaped by their environment. And as we know, chemistry and physics being the same, in many cases, nature's going to arrive at the same solutions. On the Earth, the eye evolved perhaps 11 or more times independently in different contexts, in different organisms. And that's something that happened again and again because of random mutations. And on the Earth, many organisms evolved as marsupials and as non-marsupial forms, and they look the same. So we have the equivalents of bears and tigers and dogs in the marsupial world, and they're not related at all to the bears and tigers and dogs we have that are not marsupials. So we're going to expect parallel or convergent evolution, and other worlds aren't exempt from this.
And I think that when you reach the, I'm not going to say the evolutionary end, because I'm just not sure about that. I'm a believer in a creator. But I believe that when you get to the point of pure intelligence, that you're going to have creatures that are going to be similar to us.
And that's very possible. Notice that all of the life on Earth follows a very small number of templates. Even the giraffe has the same number of neck bones that a human being does. So there are certain things that occur throughout nature that echo each other because we have common origins. If we look at other animals on other planets, they'll probably have very similar forms. Now, it's not to say we're not going to discover something very unusual or very different. I mean, look at the platypus. There's a weird animal for you.
Sure. Well, you know what? we're still finding these very different and weird and unusual creatures. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, you know, down in the depths of the ocean, they found another couple hundred more little creatures that they never knew existed. So,
yeah.
So they're out there. I mean, this universe is full of strange things.
Well, if you want to see alien life, look in the oceans.
Right.
There's some very, very strange creatures down in our seas.
How would these microbial forms of life or this marine type of life, how would it exist on Mars today if it was able to survive?
Well, some of it may exist in caverns, and we have found caverns on Mars at this point. So some could be sheltered underground, and that wouldn't be too surprising. Some of it could be in alcoves, such as the apparent brine lakes that exist on Mars, and they found five or six of those. I've got a few pictures of those on my site. There are apparently lakes of brine on the surface, and many of them could live in there, and they could go through the same sort of a life cycle that the brine shrimp does. So we could have a number of organisms that are suspended in the ice, and of course, researchers have been able to revive bacteria that have stuck in salt crystals for over 200 million years. So the evidence is very good that under the proper conditions, fossilization isn't the only option for life. Sometimes it will dry out or desiccate and go into a state of natural hibernation.
What would these creatures eat on the planet if they were there now?
Well, in any world, you have to have some sort of food for anything to live. And that also takes us to a very interesting question. What would the first organism in the world eat?
That's right.
The organic soup itself, the tholin that's around, the primordial soup, is a food. So even on Mars, there are going to be materials in the soil that bacteria and fungus could eat, and then higher creatures will live off of them. You'll notice in nature there is a tendency for tiny, very numerous organisms to spread out and collect the energy and the minerals. And it's typically diatoms or algae or bacteria doing the primary digesting and collecting. And then other organisms that are larger will feed on them. They'll graze on them. And then there's a food chain, a pyramid that goes up, larger organisms with lesser numbers eating the smaller ones that have gathered everything for them. And so we'll see the same sort of a system on any world.
That is fascinating. They do have to eat, so there's something there for them. And the big question is, how big did these creatures get? Were they whale-like, do you think?
Well, while that's possible, Mars probably didn't have a great deal of oxygen in its environment. We were going to have to look at how that limits the size of energetic organisms. I don't have any evidence of anything larger than 3 or 4 inches in length, call it 10 centimeters,
okay,
in any of the things that I've looked at. But again, we've only looked at a very small area and a very restricted one at that.
A vast oxygenated planet, like Earth was during the dinosaur era, creates larger creatures, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly tends to. It all happens to hinge on how well an organism can survive by being small and fleet and nimble, or very large and carnivorous or herbivorous. So you end up with things like the Tyrannosaurus, which is basically the meat eater, or you end up with things like a Brontosaurus, which is basically a herbivore. He grazes on the plants. But yes, you know, the size of an organism is going to be related to how effectively it can get around, how much oxygen it takes from its environment, and those sorts of factors. Now, one interesting piece of information that I've come across, and it seems nobody recognizes this, is this. Mars is the red planet because of rust, because of iron oxide. Well, what oxidized all that iron? There had to have been free oxygen, not just water, in its past, in order to make the planet rust red. And it happened on our planet billions of years ago. That's what formed the red iron deposits that we mine today.
That's a good point, Sir Charles. Good point indeed. Stay with us. Sir Charles Schultz with us for the entire program. Richard C. Hoagland joins us to share his views. We'll share their perspective together. And I'll sit back and we'll learn. We'll be back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. Okay, this should be a fascinating hour. Sir Charles Schultz III with us, along with now the head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland. Hey, Richard, how are you?
I'm fine this evening.
There you are. Where are you?
Oh, you know, on Mars.
That's right, clicking away. Sir Charles, have you two ever spoken together or met?
No, we haven't, actually. We've swapped information through second parties, intermediaries, but we've never met. Hello, Richard, how are you?
Charles, it's finally a pleasure.
Great. Richard, I wanted you on with us this hour to give us your perspective on things. Charles, of course, just a really a dialogue between two people who have studied Mars and have, in some cases, different views, in other cases, not. And, you know, this is something I think our audience would find fascinating, enjoyable, and at the same time, we'll learn a little bit more. Richard, you heard the first hour with Sir Charles, and you've been studying Mars now for how long, Mr. C., Richard C.?
It seems like forever. It's been almost 30 years. I mean, I was part of the original CBS coverage of Viking when it landed back in 1976. So I've been looking at this place for a very long time. As part of my education in how NASA really functions, as opposed to how we used to think it functions, I had my baptism of fire in the whole Cydonia face on Mars thing back in the late 80s. But I must say, I'm most perplexed by the NASA reaction to a number of the independent investigations that have converged on this really now absolutely uncontroversial statement, which is there was an extraordinarily advanced system of life on Mars, and we can see it in these rover images, close-ups of what are unquestionably fossils. I mean, we found the first fossil back in 2004 and published on it about a month after the Opportunity rover landed on Sol 33. They took an image of a place called El Capitan, which was part of that little several-inch-high set of strata in front of the rover when it landed in that little crater over in the Meridiani Sinus region. And I was blown away by the fact that within a few hours of taking the picture and sending it back to Earth and posting it on the JPL website, they then proceeded to obliterate this thing by ratting it with the tool they were using to scrape off the surface dust and get composition data of the rocks underneath. It was the most incredible, blatant example of NASA destroying priceless, incredible, once-in-a-lifetime scientific evidence. And when I saw Sir Charles get involved in this game, I just had to shake my head, because as I went through his website this evening, I noticed, Charles, you've come to the same conclusion I have, that NASA means never a straight answer, and you haven't a clue as to why they're not telling us the truth.
Well, there are some possibilities, and that societal report is one of them. And, of course, as you and I know, anytime something changes the status quo, people resist that change, and it's an unfortunate thing.
Charles, it's been half a century. We've been at this now for 50 years. You know,
sure.
You're of the school that they're dumb but honest. I'm of the school that they're as clever as all get out. They do not mean to ever tell us the truth. They are determined to take our money and do whatever they damn well please. And you and I and the few others in this field that are trying to publicly point to the taxpayer what his or her dollars are being used for are basically crying in the wilderness, because until NASA officially holds a press conference and officially acknowledges what they've been hiding, none of the press seem bright enough to, A, come in out of the rain, let alone write a story about what's being suppressed on Mars.
Well, look at the images that I've presented so far and some of the things that you've presented. I mean, there are things that are very obviously out of place, and they've been a meter or two away, arm's length away from these things, with sophisticated equipment that could analyze them and image them. And they have, in every case, turned away and driven away from them.
You know, my learning curve on this goes back to right after Spirit landed, which was a few weeks before Opportunity, on the other side of the planet, in Gusev Crater. And where it landed, and we started looking at these images, and we saw things that, I mean, this is the area where you and I probably part company, because what I see is blatantly technological junk, machinery, bits and pieces, you know, corroded, fragmented, smashed things from subsequent meteor bombardments that have been unearthed from the regolith, as well as these biological forms. But when we started looking at this, and we started publishing some of the first information, I tried, and I've never told George, I've never told anybody this before, I tried through a back channel to set up a private meeting so I could come to JPL and meet with Steve Squires, who was the principal investigator on the rover missions. And the ground rules were, and it was being arranged by an intel person that knows both of us, were that the meeting would be totally secret, that no one would ever know, that I would lay out the case, and he would give me, you know, his best case for why this could not be, you know, brought to public attention. And it was moving along until my intermediary got the word that, well, it wasn't the time to have the meeting. Suddenly, Steve wanted to delay the meeting. I mean, I've known Squires for years and years and years. We used to debate back in the Charlie Rose days when he was with CBS. I actually had an interesting debate with him on the whole Sidonia question. So I asked my intel guy if there was a way that I could get hold of Squires directly and basically just talk, you know, phone to phone so that I could find out why he suddenly didn't want to have this very quiet, no publicity, no press meeting. And my source gave me a phone number for Dr. Squires, and it turned out to be over at the Advanced Research Projects Agency, or the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. In other words, Steve Squires has an office in the Pentagon. And it was that where it suddenly crystallized. Remember, George, how we've been talking for years, how if you read the NASA charter carefully, it's not a civilian space agency. It is a DOD agency. It is arm of the U.S. defense establishment. Well, Steve Squires is obviously employed by the Pentagon, and he's the principal investigator on the rovers on Mars. So then you ask, Charles, why is this not coming to light? It's because the fix is in, my friend. And unless we change the political game, unless this president-elect, decides to do what nobody else has had the guts and courage to do for the last half century, nothing is going to change.
Well, it's come to light that some of the astronauts don't even know they work for DOD when they're working for NASA.
Well, when Ed Mitchell and I had our, quote, debate with Art years and years ago, Ed admitted on air that he did not realize that he worked for DOD still, that he hadn't really, you know, resigned his commission and gone to work for a civilian agency like he thought he had done. Nobody knows. I mean, that's why I wrote a whole book with Mike Barra called Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. And, you know, there's voluminous evidence, political evidence throughout the book, which we document meticulously, that we have been fed a bunch of lies about NASA from now till the cows come home. The question I have for you is, how do you plan to change it?
Well, Richard, one of my contentions is they use information control. For instance, they will mix classified data with non-classified data, and then it all becomes classified. And so anybody who signed that non-disclosure agreement runs their nose into a glass wall there they didn't realize was there. And when they try to talk about anything that they do find, well, you know, there is true censorship in the government and in NASA these days about scientific research. And the U.S. Geological Survey just recently ran afoul of that with the reports on the climate. So they are indeed censoring scientific information, and there's a great deal of evidence about that, and it has been confirmed by the Inspector General during his review of what occurred during some of the climate data.
So the question is, how do we change it?
It's going to be a very difficult path. I don't know if there's an easy way, but I think that what we're doing, getting the information out there, and there is so much information, just getting it out there for people so that they're aware of it, is the first step in the process.
Were you called by Miles O'Brien to be part of his In Search of Aliens series this last week?
No, I was not, but I've been
and a little hard to
meet. And
neither was I. And, George, are you familiar with this story?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And Miles O'Brien, who was head of a special science unit at CNN involving environment, energy, and space, has now been fired as of yesterday.
Laid off, right?
He's been there for 17 years. He actually took over from my friend what's his last name? He was killed in a very tragic car crash years ago, and then Miles took his place. The literally days after he publishes or airs a segment of his In Search of Aliens series, which discussed one of the Martian fossils, I think it was
right.
The one that we found back in 2004.
And I thought he did a pretty good job, Richard.
Oh, he did, except
yeah.
He didn't talk to me.
No.
Talk to Charles. I mean, we're the guys look actually doing the science here. And yet, he just by raising the specter, suddenly he's toast. So how do you fight that kind of power?
Well, I find it very interesting that many people that touch on controversial subjects such as alien life or alternative forms of energy do seem to meet with an untimely end.
And that was your, by the way,
defense, you know, for our well-being, that a lot of people perceive us as being slightly loony.
That was John Holloman who died in the car.
John Holloman, yeah.
Good guy. Good report.
Well, what's really tragic, George, is that his mysterious death occurred literally a couple of days after I talked with him on the phone. And, again, arranged through an intermediary who was a friend of both of ours. And he had basically agreed to receive a very large packet of information, videos, images, et cetera, with our work on both Mars and the Moon. And he was going to look into the idea that our hypotheses are, in fact, real science and not flaky stuff and could be tested and should be aired. And two or three days after that, he's dead.
He's dead.
At least yeah. Miles is still, you know, running around without a job now, but his transgression seemed to be that he stepped over some boundary, some imaginary line, where he dealt seriously with the prospect that NASA had seen and photographed and recorded and archived at U.S. taxpayers' expense evidence of former advanced life on Mars. And suddenly, he is gone.
Now, both you and Charles see fossils on Mars. Richard, you see some other things, the pyramids, the face. Sir Charles has his views on that. But the fact that I think both of you believe that life existed on the planet, albeit how intelligent, you both have different views on that as well. But I still think it's pretty remarkable that you're at least walking down a path of similarity to some respect.
Well, there's a lot of information to deal with, and I think that any reasonable person who has any background in science, who observes this information, has the ability to draw a reasonable conclusion from it.
You know, when you look at Mars in terms of comparative biology, and you look at it and the Earth, you know, side by side, and you realize, because we have ground truth here, that we have a great deal of information on the origin of life, when it occurred, how it developed, various stages, the various mass extinctions, the vicissitudes it's gone through, where it is now, the fact that most of life on Earth is extinct and only available to us in the form of fossils. And then you look next door on Mars and you find not only fossils, but see, this is where, again, I think Charles and I part company a bit. It blew me away when the fossil we found, the first one, was identified as a crinoid. Now, crinoids are very specific to terrestrial oceans and to the Darwinian theory of evolution, which says, a la George Gaillard Simpson, who was a big mucky-muck in the whole evolution of biology crowd back in the 1950s out of Harvard, he basically, you know, set the case that any life form on Earth will never be duplicated by any other planet because evolution is random. It is a Darwinian selection of the fittest, therefore a different environment, different creatures, end of story. So you go to Mars, and you look at these pictures, and you see things, you know, like the crinoids that I found, or the trilobites that Charles has found, or the brachiopods, or any of this stuff, and you can identify it literally almost to a museum case at, you know, in the Peabody Museum there at Harvard, and you got to say, wait a minute, this is impossible by any science we think we know.
Well, Richard, that's because it was based on opinion that other life forms on other worlds would be completely different.
Yes, but politics, Charles, politics is opinion. That's my point. These people are not acting scientifically. They're acting politically and religiously, even though they're supposed to be scientists and the people controlling them are supposed to be, you know, under the Constitution, you separate church and state and you proceed with the science, the wherever the science leads. And at some level, there's a choke point where I frankly think it's because of this incredible similarity of life on Mars to life on Earth that has caused the power structure to freak out and place incredible national security clamps on this data and, you know, pain of, you know, being fired or losing their grants and everything else to all the, you know, the guys in the trenches. And that's why nothing ever officially comes out, because ultimately, what this is telling us is that one of two ideas that are at the cornerstone of either the religious perspective or the scientific perspective is not true. Religiously, you know, people grow up like I was a Roman Catholic, basically being taught that life was created by God here, and that was it. Now, if we find that there's life on Mars, and it's in some level identical to life here, that opens a can of religious worms that you will never close the door on. To go to the science side, scientists believe in their religion that Darwinian evolution is random. If, in fact, you go to Mars and you find identical, I mean, the reason you're able to identify these fossils, Charles, and me either, is because they look so similar to stuff we can find here on Earth.
Well, that's exactly the point. We
and
recognize
that not
what
be,
we know.
You kind of pass over this lightly, but that's a huge, huge biggie. That is such a no-no. That means, if we discard the religious paradigm for a second, that means scientifically there is something overwhelmingly important about biology and life and the origin of life on this place and Mars and God knows how many other places that means that it's not as diversified as we've been told it should be. And if that could be proven, that would completely upset everything science thinks it knows about evolution or biology. And there's an awful lot of PhDs, Charles, and you know this, who would not want their careers upset by these annoying facts.
Well, absolutely right. And the thing is here, the views we have been given are purely opinions. You can't draw a case from a single scientific data point like the Earth. There are billions of worlds, and we've not been able to observe any of them to create a graph or a trend from.
And the first one we go to, we find stuff that
very
literally
one.
Find right. in a museum case in Boston. That cannot happen under any science you and I both know.
Well, and again, you know, when people push opinions on us as science and then say, well, that's the way it is, and I'll give you another example of that. We're told time and again that you have to have a large magnetic field to hold your atmosphere. Well, we know that's not true. Look at Venus. It has over 70 times the air pressure we have, and it doesn't have any appreciable magnetic field. So what's keeping its atmosphere there? Certainly not the magnetic field being an issue.
Have you been following, just changing subject slightly, this red rain story out of India some years
ago? Yes, I have. I have followed that.
I read a recent paper today, the two guys at one of India's universities who actually did fluorescence studies, and they found that these little things that look like cells without DNA that reproduce at high temperatures, that have all the requisites of life, meaning they can make more of themselves, that they fluoresce this wonderful ultraviolet blue under ultraviolet light. I mean, they appear to have been an alien life form dumped into the atmosphere through maybe a comet or a meteor entering mm-hmm. over India. And there's now a study, which I encountered as I was searching through this, that this red rain stuff has been happening with other meteor showers or meteor entering the atmosphere going back about 100 years. They've got correlations from all over the world of these incidences of, you know, bays or ponds or creeks turning red with something that dumped out of the sky when a meteor entered and basically blew up. Now, Whoa. If that's true, if that stuff is alive, it is so alien to terrestrial life, you have to ask the question, well, where did it come from? If the only other planet that's like Earth that we really have explored, which is Mars, is turning up life forms that are so incredibly Earth-like, and far beyond the normal theory.
Well, consider this. If these are actually alien organisms of some sort, then they're not based on genetics. They're working on some other chemical process that we're not familiar with. But the other thing to consider is this. Virtually every organic meteorite, such as the carbonaceous chondrites, that falls to Earth, appears to contain what look like microfossils. Every single one of them does. And nobody seems to confront that issue either.
That's true. We'll be back with Sir Charles Schulz, Richard C. Hoagland in a moment. Next hour, Sir Charles will take your phone calls. Absolutely. Our guests, Sir Charles Schulz, Richard C. Hoagland, this hour, phone calls with Sir Charles. Next hour, Sir Charles has a brand new book out there now called A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. We'll talk with him a little bit more about that in a moment. And Richard C. Hoagland, of course, has a DVD out as well. Kind of unusual and different, but for Richard, more research went into it. The Hyperdimensional Election of Barack Obama in 2012. That's available on his enterprisemission.com website, or there's a toll-free number, 877-345-6222. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Sir Charles Schultz III and Richard C. Hoagland as well. Sir Charles, I want to spend a lot of time next hour talking about the Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. When are we going to go there, Richard and Sir Charles, so we can look for these fossils?
Well, during the break, I had a call from one of my sources who pointed out that we're very close to the transition where we don't need NASA anymore. There already is a vigorous amateur astronomer effort all around the world taking images of Mars with better and better technology, computers, CCDs. I mean, you can now have amateur imagery of Mars that is light years beyond what professionals anywhere in the world, including in places like Palomar, in the last decades were able to bring, you know, to bear on these problems, because the technology revolution just keeps going on and on and on. And, you know, if it weren't for the distance, the huge distance, 35 million miles at its closest approach, amateurs would be able to basically outdo NASA in some of these studies. But the distance factor means you're going to have a private space effort unless you can somehow get a political break by firing the people on the top of NASA and putting in new people that will basically be, you know, honoring their commitment to the American people to tell them the truth. If most Americans, Charles, were to realize that they have been so lied to from the beginning about what's out there, don't you think there would be almost a violent revolution in the streets?
Well, I do. And, you know, one of the key indicators is any time you hear somebody talking about this and they look at the Mars images and they go, well, the chances of this being life, you know what? They've just failed critical thinking 101, because they don't have any other samples to work with. They can't calculate the odds. They're blowing smoke.
Yep. Now, I want to talk about the color, because I was reading very carefully your analysis of the color. And again, George, it's amazing how Charles and I, who have never met, never even talked, have independently come to so many of the same conclusions. Our areas of agreement are far more broad than our potential areas of disagreement. Why don't you talk, Charles, about the color of Mars and how you prove, as we have proven, they're lying and covering up the real colors of Mars for some reason.
Well, you know, I've got a couple of chapters of information in the book that covers all of this in great detail, but I'll try to get to the key sticking points here. Every time you see a piece of the images that show the rovers in testing, they have yellow or orange lighting on the rovers. And why is that? You know, when they dropped the rovers on the surface of the planet, the sensors saw that the light curves on the ground were absolutely identical with the light curves on the Earth, with the difference of sunlight just being a little less intense. So the color of the sky is the same. And when you look at the images, you often see these strange orange dusty false color composites. Well, they've added infrared into the picture. We can't see infrared. You can't add the L2 filter from those things in, because it changes the colors terribly. So for some reason, they're altering the color of the images. And if you look at their calibration sundial, you have a reference point from which you can get very realistic color. So when you look at the sky, you look at the different images, the ones that show the brightest sky color are invariably the green, blue, and violet spectrum, which means that the sky is blue.
Why do you think they're lying about the color and have been since 1976?
Well, one of the most interesting
things here. Come on, be honest here.
If it looks like it's not Earth, then nobody can accuse them of having the rover in the desert somewhere.
Okay.
That's one very good reason, you know, because a lot of people are very upset about what they feel was a lie about going to the moon. Oh, no, we went to the moon. We had people on the moon. That's not a problem. But if they drop the rover on Mars and the sky is blue and the ground looks like Arizona, people are going to wonder if they really are on Mars. And I think that this is one of their, you know, CYA moves. You cover everything with orange and it can't possibly be the Earth.
Well, I've heard a lot of theories, Charles, but I got to say, I got to hand it to you for spinning on that one, because that is the most benign conspiracy theory regarding NASA I have ever heard. Don't you think it's a little more pointed?
Well, I do know that it isn't the average worker in NASA who has a problem with hiding information. It has to be at the management level, because people aren't allowed to say what they find. I mean, keep in mind, they had an oceanographer on the team when they were analyzing the first rover images to come back.
Gosh,
and you've always said, Richard, you believe that the rank and file of NASA, they're out there doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, I've said most of the system is honest. And Charles is exactly right. This is policy from the top. The question is, why is the policy still in place? We don't believe in Brookings. We certainly don't believe that we're going to go running amok on the streets and, you know, as they said in Ghostbusters, cats and dogs living together, et cetera, if we know that we're not the only life forms in the universe. So, again, Charles, the big picture is, why the cover-up?
I think that there's a potential, if everybody knew that there was alien life and perhaps intelligent alien life, that it might actually have a unifying effect, and perhaps that's something that isn't wanted.
Now, that's an interesting angle.
Hmm.
Well, if we had a common enemy, as we've done in times past during warfare, people unite and become stronger when they have a common enemy. If everybody on Earth thought that there was some common threat, it may cause an amazing grouping together of people. It actually may cause peace. It may cause people to work together. I don't know. Again, this is pure speculation on my part. But, you know, there's an awful lot of strange stuff that comes out of government agencies. So you know that they're not telling you the truth all the time. I'm not a conspiracy nut or a conspiracy advocate, but there's an awful lot we see that makes no sense.
Well, Richard, do me a favor, too. Would you tell Sir Charles your theory and Tom Van Flandern's theory of what you two believe happened to Mars? Because I'd like to get Sir Charles' reaction to that.
Well, Tom's model, and he was the one actually that formulated this in the beginning. We found really amazing confirmatory evidence some years ago, is that Mars used to be a satellite of a larger planet that orbited basically in the asteroid belt. Something caused that planet to blow up about 65 million years ago, liberating Mars and another moon to go into separate orbits around the sun. Mars orbit, as you know, is the most elliptical of the inner planets, actually out to Neptune. And that excursion of ellipticity, Tom believes, who's a celestial mechanics expert, he was head of celestial mechanics at the U.S. Naval Observatory, as you may know. So, you know, that's his bailiwick. He pegs that to the liberation of Mars from an orbit around this more massive planet that he calls Planet 5. This other smaller moon that was liberated in the explosion of the primary at the same time, he then postulates from other celestial mechanics data, primarily orbits of comets and new comets, you know, the first-timers. It blew up roughly 3.2 million years ago, and I was intrigued to hear you say in your first hour that you now believe that these glaciers they're finding through the radar efforts of both the Mars Express mission and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter mission are only a few million years old, covered by, you know, an inch or so of dust and sand and stuff like that. Wouldn't that fit neatly into a very young change in the Martian environment? As opposed to NASA's, it's billions and billions of years old thing.
Well, it's true, but consider that if you add the mass of all the asteroids in the main belt together, they only about 1% of the mass of our moon. The type of an explosion necessary to destroy an entire planet would be absolutely incredible, and there'd be a lot more far-reaching effects, I would feel, than simply leaving Mars behind. That sort of an explosion would literally rip one face off the planet. We don't see any evidence of that.
Well, we actually do. We see an immense dichotomy between the two hemispheres of Mars, northern and southern. I mean, that's a whole program in itself. We don't have time to fight that war tonight. But Tom and I have gone through the evidence, and he lists an extraordinary litany of things we should see that we do see. The question, of course, that everybody asks who looks at this data then says, well, what's the energy source to blow a planet apart? And that's where we come to the hyperdimensional physics model, which, again, we don't have time to go into tonight. But in terms of your work, if the Mars environment was much more benign, much more recently, a few million years, as opposed to a few billion years, wouldn't it change the entire equation and make what you've been finding much more understandable in terms of preservation?
Well, absolutely. In fact, I believe that the environment on Mars has been far more benign than we've been told. And if you think about it, the Martian meteorites that they found have indicated that there was liquid water on the surface at the age of only 4.4 billion years. So Mars, being smaller had to cool faster than the Earth, and it had to have liquid water on its surface more readily than the Earth did.
But you draw the line at two planets with evolution that's almost comparable, you know, a billion years here, a billion there. You draw the line at anything artificial or intelligent. Why is that?
I haven't seen anything that convinces me, and as a scientist, I've got to stick with the facts. I've got to stick with things that I can measure and confirm.
But you see the biological forms, and you don't take much to convince you on that.
No, not at all. I am absolutely certain there's biology.
Have you seen the Martian ocean liner?
I've seen the shorelines that were calculated to have existed in times past.
Okay, but you haven't seen the ocean liner.
Is this is this that picture,
the one
Richard?
I showed you that you freaked out about at Joshua Tree.
Right, okay, the one that has that dragging look to it?
The two-mile-long drag mark across the surface.
Yeah, and I did that.
And
it is
comes
weird.
To rest, and it looks like a fossilized, you know, Queen Mary, Charles.
Yeah, it does. It's a weird picture, Charles.
Well, I would imagine if I saw something like that, that it could very well be a large-shaped boulder moved by a glacier. I wouldn't
Would you like to know how big this is?
Sure, why not?
It's 2,000 feet long.
Okay.
It's the size of the biggest oil tanker on Earth. Scale up a little bit, you know, because of Martian gravity. 2,000 feet as an ocean-going vessel on Mars is not untoward at all, given the, you know, different wave heights, different sinusoidal wave frequencies, et cetera, et cetera. What's astonishing, and the thing that convinced me that it couldn't be a mesa, is, as George just said, there's a 10,000-foot-long slide mark before this thing came to rest. It's the damnedest thing you ever saw, George, right?
Yeah, it is weird. I don't know what it is, but it is weird.
So
well,
what
personally,
I
have a much easier time believing in organisms, particularly when we see the fossils.
Charles, it's not about belief.
You know,
throw out the concept of belief. You already crossed the belief barrier. Once you started writing and publishing that there was life on Mars, you have joined us crazies. you may pretend to still keep one foot in another world, but notice how you've been ostracized.
Well,
none
the
of the people
plate tectonics guy was crazy until they discovered he was absolutely right, and Chandrasekhar was crazy until the leading astronomer of the day died. And you know, a lot of the people who make fundamental discoveries are considered to be crazy, and then when they're discovered to have been right. You know, it all comes down to preconceived notions and intellectual control of the information.
Did you read the story of a couple, 3 weeks ago, where Chandra Vikramasinghe, who you obviously know.
He's the
well,
Red Rain guy, right?
Well, yeah, he was involved in that late, but he's written books with Fred Hoyle about panspermia, about virus outbreaks on Earth being caused by us passing through spores and microbes and viruses from comets and, you know, in basically celestial rain of debris in the solar system, that life exists in space, it can move between worlds, you know, that in fact probably life was seeded from space on Earth. He came out a few weeks ago with a very remarkable interview where he flat out, Charles, said that NASA was hiding, covering up life on Mars. And
he attributed it
speculatively to some national security reasons, but he basically couldn't be any more specific. It's like everyone dances around the idea that we are not supposed to know. We're supposed to give them all our money, you know, like the banks, we give them all our money, right? But we're never supposed to hold them accountable for actually delivering the goods we're paying for.
Well, okay, and you've touched on something that I've run into many times. Now, collectively, they will never admit anything, but I've met and spoke to many scientists individually, and individually, to a man, every one of them says, you know, I can't see any other explanation. Those have got to be fossils.
So why don't we get them all together in a room and hold a press conference?
Well, here's the thing. The bottom line is, I've been told by many people, it's professional suicide to admit that you see fossils.
Yeah, unless you make $1 million with Hollywood. Then who cares if it's professional suicide? Look, there's got to be a way to break this logjam, because I'm not going to go to my grave never knowing.
Well, I have to agree with that, and that's exactly why I'm in this. People need to know what our money paid for and the facts about there is life in the universe.
So we have a new game in town in Washington in 47 days. What
Let's
can you
hope.
And I do, pooling our resources, our talent, our time, our contacts, what can we do together? You know, as Ben Franklin said, if we don't hang together, we will hang separately.
Well, and you know you've got the support of this show, Richard. You know.
Well, I kind of thought that, George, but thank you for underscoring it.
Yes.
And through the show, Charles, we have several million taxpayers, voters, who obviously, if the trend curves, you know, are matching what the national polls are, most of the people listening to us tonight voted to put Barack Obama in the Oval Office. So what can we all do together to, damn it, get our Constitution and NASA back and do what it should have been doing for the last 50 years, which is telling us the truth?
Well, Richard, regardless of the differences in what we believe and our conclusions that we've drawn, I think it would probably be very useful for us to talk and see what we could do, because I think that we both together have some very formidable resources.
I think I agree, and I'm totally open to the idea.
Okay.
All right, Richard, my friend, I want to thank you for joining us this hour, all right?
It's been my pleasure, George. Charles, enjoy your questions.
Thank you, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
That's Richard C. Hoagland. Now, Charles, we're going to take phone calls with you next hour. Tell me about the Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars.
I certainly will. All of the information that I've gathered over the last nearly 5 years, I've presented in one volume. I cover the formation of the planets, where the origins of the ocean and atmosphere come from, what you expect to find. And it's basically nearly 400 pages of information, plenty of illustrations, and it's in an electronic format and later will be in a hardback. And I've got it on the site right now for anyone to see. But I cover all of these issues and many more that we've discussed tonight, many of the anomalies people aren't even aware of. And I urge people to have a look at it. There are two test chapters on my site they can download for free just to see the quality of work. And I also cover the existence of present-day water on Mars. I have direct pictures of the geysers, water on the soil. There's a good chapter on the hydrological cycle on Mars as well. So this is really basically a highly referenced book, footnotes for everything. You can verify every piece of information in it. And I'd like to stress that we can get them out to people quickly for Christmas. If you know somebody who's into science, into technology, and you don't want know what to get them, I think that this would be an ideal gift for them.
And you can get it, as you say, off your website. Spell your website for us.
Okay. It's xenotechresearch.com, and it's X-E-N-O-T-E-C-H-R-E-S-E-A-R-C-H.
Not to be confused with the Xenotech Research, which is the little apparatus for people's complexion. Did you know
that? I haven't heard of that one.
They spell it with a Z.
Oh, no. No, this is with the X.
Very good. Let's make sure we make that distinction and that difference. You know, what's amazing with you and Richard is, you know, you're far apart on many, many issues, but you believe in life on Mars. And that alone is pretty dramatic, I think, to get a couple people on a program who believe that way.
Well, and we've both taken our own avenues to reach those points. And, you know, we found different things, but we do agree that biology has to be common throughout the universe. And there are very good reasons for that, you know, chemistry and physics being what they are and what we've discovered being what it is.
When we come back, we'll take your phone calls with Sir Charles Schultz III on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, along with Sir Charles Schultz and your phone calls. So you do agree, though, that there is government censorship, you believe, on some scientific research, Charles?
Well, that's been proven by the Inspector General, among other people, yes.
Why are they doing it?
Well, that's the question. You know, it seems that they feel that some information may tweak people the wrong way, and some of it goes against the messages or agendas they seem to be promoting. You know, nobody's going to really do much about the global warming issue until they either agree that it is or isn't true, and whether they can make money off of you and I to correct the situation.
Well, that's so true. So true indeed. What do you think of the other explorations that are going on around this solar system off into the universe as well?
We've got a lot of really interesting data coming back from Cassini as it orbits Saturn, and one of the latest findings is Enceladus, one of Saturn's moons, which is about 300 kilometers across. It's a ball of water ice. It appears to be spouting water vapor and organic chemicals from geysers or cracks at its south pole. So they're flying through the plume from time to time and collecting and analyzing the material. Now, that's a very interesting thing, because this means there's one more place where potentially we could find life.
Absolutely. Let's go to the phones. Mike in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Oh, George and Sir Charles, how are you two this evening?
Great.
Good. Sir Charles, I do a lot of studying of on astronomy. I've done it ever since I was a child. And Mars has always fascinated me and still does, even more so now since we found, you know, evidence of water and possibly fossils, as you said. I do believe that some form of life had to exist because Mars is obviously the most Earth-like planet in our solar system besides us. And I think always thought this potential for life did exist there, you know, possibly not intelligent life as we might think of it, like you said, lower animals, possibly microorganisms. But also agree with your, when you were talking with Richard Hoagland a while ago about the sky color on Mars. You know, they always said that, well, you know, when you see the color of the sky, it looks tan with an absence of clouds. And they always say that it's caused the suspended dust particles in the atmosphere. Okay, that's possible, but doesn't, you know, why doesn't this dust ever settle and reveal the true color of the sky, which I also believe to be blue?
Well, this is the issue. The Mars air is so thin that dust and particles will settle very rapidly, roughly 4 to 5 times faster than they will in our atmosphere. So particles that are small enough to remain suspended would be so tiny that they actually would not show their color. They would actually scatter the light and make it blue-gray. So, you know, it goes against common sense and it goes against physics and optics. The air is too thin to keep the dust suspended for very long.
That's what I was thinking, too. And then the wind, you know, velocity on Mars would surely, you know, blow that dust around, you know, and keep it, it wouldn't just hang in the air, you know, because the air is not still on Mars. It has currents, you know, the same as Earth does. Also, I think one of the first ports of call that this is why we need a manned mission to Mars, because sending up rovers and robotics is not the same thing as having a human being up there to see what was actually there, like you said, what the true colors are, the and also visiting some of the sites where some of these aquifers and water sources are percolating up from under the surface. I've always thought that there was liquid water below the surface.
Well, we've got a couple of commercial space companies in the wings right now, and some of them are already flying hardware, such as SpaceX. When you think about that, it wouldn't be very difficult for us to place a regular drugstore camera on the surface of the planet and get the answers to those questions very easily.
Yeah, because
if we could find some backers, we could send our own mission to Mars.
Right. Well, the pictures wouldn't be doctored that way, you know, like you said, that to make it look differently, and also... I think another one of our ports of call should be the areas where you have these brine ponds, like you were talking about. That, and I've seen pictures of some of these on the internet. And I think an astronaut there, you know, they could take instruments, just like we test water here on Earth, and test it for microorganisms.
Well, it's interesting that on this Follow the Water mission, both rovers, neither of them had either sensor for water in any form, solid, liquid, or vapor. And when they landed the Phoenix and the polar regions of Mars, it sat on top of the block of ice for 2 months before they could make a positive identification that it was water ice. You know, that seems ridiculous when you come right down to it.
Absolutely. Next up, let's go to Dave in Las Vegas. Hello, David. First-time caller, huh?
Yes, definitely. Been listening for years. But I've been dying to ask, since they showed pictures a while back on NBC News, one time, it's not enough comment to mean anything, of a small a fossil, which after 50 years, I don't remember what it was. I thought it was a trilobite. Then I thought, well, maybe not trilobite, but something else. It's been that long since I took a class in geology at the University of Nevada in Reno. And no one ever commented on that fossil. And to me, that was obvious suppression of information, you know. I couldn't believe somebody from the network didn't have the nerve to say something about it. As far as I'm concerned, they showed the entire world that night proof of life on Mars at one time.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. It's really amazing to me how much information people are bathed in and how little they actually understand or apprehend. And when we get pictures back from another world, many times anomalies are dismissed simply by saying, oh, well, it's not really what it looks like. You're just seeing, you know, something you want to see.
Well, that wasn't an accidental coincidence of arrangement of minerals, I'm sure. In fact, as George and others frequently say, there are no coincidences.
So true. Thanks, David.
Yes, thank you.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Let's go to Randy in Washington State of. Hey, Randy, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to kind of go at this at a different angle for you and
sure.
See what you think. Biblically, if you look at this biblically, if God created man and woman, He created man to use 100% of his brain power at that point in time. And the ancients were able to do so many things that we can't even begin to do today. The best people, we just can't produce anything that they were able to do back then. Now, the tombs, they've got pictures of submarines, the helicopter, and the Abrams tank, it looks like. And, shoot, they've got all kinds of stuff that they found in tombs that they thought it was a bird at one time, and it ended up, they scaled it up, and it's a stinking jet. If you put an engine on it, it would fly. So if we're so naive to think that man, if back then was able to use 100% of their brain power, why couldn't they have been able to build the spaceships and go to Mars and go into outer space? Because they've got pictures already of spacesuits, men in spacesuits, and craft. So at the Tower of Babel, God said that man, at a collective, if they would have got together, they could have done anything that they wanted to do. So it's naive for us to think that they did not have the capability to literally go into space.
You know, intellectual capability is an amazing thing, and we blunt it every day with games and television and distractions and loud music, and nobody ever sits alone by themselves for a while in the quiet and thinks anymore. And, you know, we run into this a lot. Recently, with NASA's program to build the Constellation and our new moon ships, they run into problems they don't seem to be able to solve because they went the wrong way around designing the thing. I think it comes back to what I call the slide rule syndrome. 30, 40, 50 years ago, people had to use a slide rule rather than a computer. They had to know exactly what they were doing. They had to understand the problems. They had to know how to work them out in their head and with pencil and paper.
Right.
They had a very, very deep appreciation of the issues and how to solve them. Today, that's not the case. People punch some numbers into a keyboard and get an answer, but they don't really gut level understand what they've done. They don't really know it. My contention is this. The people that sent us to the moon are dead or retired. The people working at NASA now are pretty much warming their chairs in many cases.
Good point. Good point indeed. Wildcard line, Bob in Los Angeles. What's the weather like, Bob? Warm,
the
right?
Weather, it is cold.
Oh, really?
Freezing.
Huh.
It is so cold out here. You would believe I'm sitting in my car freezing, but I got to
I'll be back soon enough. I'll bring some of St. Louis's frigid weather with me, too.
Yeah, no one knows where you are. You're like all over the place. You're in different.
I'm bouncing around. They can't catch me.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. We as long as we got you.
You got me.
Anyway, as for us to tell that, hey, I just noticed after you've been listening to you forever, it's like Tommy's done a real. He's doing a much better job screening calls. I remember a long time ago, the drunk people would be calling, but he's doing a great job, Tommy. I'm not working for the guy, but he's doing a much better job. A lot of the callers are fantastic. He gets through now. But anyway. I was just wondering, this panspermia thing, like people say that this planet was seeded from another planet, something hit a planet with life on it and freeze-dried the microorganisms, landed on this planet, it heated up, and then microorganisms breeded life on this planet. But if you think about it for a minute, if life came from another planet to seed us, then that planet was seeded by another planet, and that planet was seeded by another planet. It keeps going. So where did life start?
Space itself appears to be a bioreactor. Organic chemicals form from non-organic chemicals all the time. Given only energy, basic chemistry, and some water, we're going to find that life will form just about anywhere. It is opportunistic. And once the first single little organism begins to reproduce, it'll spread like mad. So it isn't too amazing. I mean, it's amazing to me. People haven't recognized the fact that much organic material was in the asteroid belt, and many of that could be carried in comets or asteroids all over a solar system. So we do find what appears to be microfossils in meteorites today, and we definitely find amino acids and other biological chemicals. So it shouldn't be very amazing to find that life would be everywhere.
Okay, next up, first-time caller TJ driving around in Illinois. Hey, TJ, go ahead.
Yeah. Here, not too long ago, wasn't there an asteroid or a comet that hit Mars? And if it did, how long would it take for the dust to settle down in Mars?
It was a comet that hit Jupiter.
Oh,
I'm sure,
Jupiter? Okay.
Yeah, Jupiter. But I mean, and I'm sure little things are constantly hitting the moon and Mars, but as they are Earth, but nothing big yet.
Well, they had an asteroid that approached very close to Mars, and they weren't certain if it was going to strike the planet or not. But if it had hit the atmosphere, or if it had hit the planet, there would have been a lot of dust and material scattered. But we're not really certain how long that material would remain in the atmosphere. It depends on the impact energy. And here's another interesting point. When an asteroid strikes the Earth, it has a great deal of energy because it falls through into a very strong gravitational field, our own. But an asteroid hitting Mars or a meteor hitting Mars has only about a quarter of the impact energy given the same incoming velocity relative to the planet's gravitation. It wouldn't hit as hard. It wouldn't destroy everything in a hit.
Okay.
There you go, now, TJ. Thank you. Next up, International Line, Calgary, Canada. Hey, Clark, go ahead.
How you doing, George? How also,
good.
Charles. Silicate life forms and variations on it, like small life forms like, say, diatoms, they leave behind a nice, almost pure silicate shell. And I'm just wondering, you know, what we've got up on Mars, what we have. We found some stuff up on, I was up at a place called Elef Rignes Island up in the Arctic. And the geologist there found some rocks, and he said he had never seen anything like it. We put it under the microscope, and then when we left the island, we got raided by the government, and they just took everything. They said, no, you can't go up there. And if you wanted to go up there to explore now, it's totally restricted.
Ah, you know, that's interesting. They found this white, sparkly material in some of the Gusev crater areas, and they said it was almost pure silica. Well, you know what? That stays right in line with the ocean hypothesis. Diatoms are one of the basics of your food chain, and they would be present probably in any ocean because they absorb the primary dissolved minerals and the sunlight and convert it to food for other organisms. So there shouldn't be any surprise in finding layers of diatoms or fine silica on Mars. In fact, it appears to be alternated in the sedimentary rocks in many places, and that would indicate seasonal changes in their population on Mars.
Sir Charles, what fascinates you the most about Mars? Everything you've looked at, everything you've investigated.
I think what fascinates me the most is that it's close enough that we could probably reach it in a reasonable period of time and actually explore it hands-on. It's just an amazing world, and there are so many parallels, and it actually is kind of an indicator of what could be in the future of the Earth eventually.
Sure. Okay, next up, let's go to Greg in New Hampshire. Hey, Greg, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing, George?
Great.
And Charles.
Yes.
I think Richard might have touched on something there when he was speaking to you about getting all you top scientist guys together for a news conference, but he missed one other half that you absolutely need, and that would be get the top religious people of all the denominations together with the scientists and have them all come together and admit that it would be to God's greater glory to admit that he created other life elsewhere in the universe.
Well, you know, you've hit on a very interesting point and something that I often relate to people who come at me with the religious angle. And I point out that when they say, well, God created the earth and that's it, and I say to them, well, I don't know who your God is, but my God can create trillions of living worlds, not just one.
Well, that's true. Eric in Rhode Island, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Eric, go ahead.
Hi, Judge. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Good
love your shows. My question is that if with these rovers and we discovered that there is some form of life out there, wouldn't that negate the efforts of trying to put a man to Mars, you know, the money and everything else that you got to spend? Because when we went to the moon, it's been 30 years that we haven't gone back there. We seem to have lost interest. So if we send people there or we find that there's life, wouldn't we lose interest on that point alone?
I don't think so. The trip to the moon was purely a political move. It was a power play. We were in a competition with the Soviet Union, and we had to win. And once we'd done that, the momentum was gone. So whatever the plan was, it had played out, and that was the end of it. And scientific concerns were actually not very well represented in the lunar missions. It took major work to convince them to carry an actual geologist. And as we know, there was only, I understand, one geologist that really went to the moon to study the moon. So if we go to Mars, it's probably going to be under an entirely different scenario. We're probably going to have a much larger investment from the private sector, and we will also learn from the rovers what we need to avoid and what we need to look for. So I think of the rovers as the first guard. You know, they're going to tell us an awful lot, and they have. So we know a lot more of what to expect when we actually do send people. And let me tell you something else. When we do send people, the difficulty of reaching a planet will pretty much mean that they're going to have to stay there for a significant period of time.
Oh, absolutely. But also I'd like to make another point on if we did find some kind of primitive life out there, that would only reinforce our belief that there's got to be more life out there, intelligent life. And, you know, when like that other gentleman that was talking about the God and everything else, I'm a big fan of Stanton Freeman, and I've listened to a lot of his talks. And one thing I have to agree with, if we ever had an intelligent life that came out here, they're not going to make themselves known to us, because our concept of our religion and our nationalities would all, like, implode what our beliefs are. And I believe that that would be detrimental to what we believe in. And like you had said earlier, that a higher form would destroy a lower form of intelligence.
Well, keeping that in mind, we know that if we were going to explore another world that had intelligences on it, we would not come in showboating. We would come in very subtly. We would collect information. We would watch from a distance until we were ready to actually introduce ourselves. And then that's a sensible thing to do. We don't want to disrupt a culture. And hopefully anyone visiting our world would have the same sort of ethics in place. They wouldn't want to disrupt a culture.
We'll be back with final phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed, indeed. On our next Coast to Coast program, of course, after our first interview, it'll be those Friday into Saturday morning open lines. But let's come right back, and we'll take final phone calls with Sir Charles on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Sir Charles Schultz, author of A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. We'll tell you again how you can get that book in just a few minutes. Charles, you've got the experience in robotics and artificial intelligence as well. I am amazed lately at these robots that I see, especially the Japanese creating. Now they've got a few of them in an actual play, and the robots are going to be, you know, actors. It's amazing, with lines.
Well, we're making a huge number of strides in robotics, and it's like anything. Once you've got the recipe for the basics, you can embellish and add until you make another big discovery, and we're going to see huge advances in the next 5 to 10 years, too. I expect to see, like Joe Engelberger's helpers for the medically infirm, and people are going to want household help that does things basically without their supervision. We're not quite to that point, but we will be soon.
I think so, too. And you know what? Who knows? Where do you think we'll be in 20 years with robots?
Well, I'd say in 20 years that self-driving and operating vehicles will probably be very common. I would expect that many of the common tasks we do, like mowing the yard and painting the house and cleaning the gutters, could probably be handled by robotics. And I also expect to see a hybrid stove refrigerator unit that will cook a meal for you once it's programmed, just as a precursor of things to come.
That's just amazing. But you think that we'll have robots like chauffeurs? They'll take us all over the place?
Well, actually, you won't see an obvious robot in that case. It'll probably be the vehicle itself.
Yeah.
Has a built-in module that performs the task, such as voice activation, GPS, that sort of thing.
What about emotion? Will they ever have emotion?
Well, now, we know that robots and some of the existing computers can recognize facial expressions and read emotion from that, and they also have a robot that can mimic your facial expressions, show the same emotional responses that you show. But when you consider that emotion is really something that happens in your head, and software can be developed to do the same thing, it wouldn't surprise me if down the road robots could have emotions. And I've got a few examples of that. I'm working on the possibility of a book on artificial intelligence, and I've written up exactly how that could be achieved.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. Bakersfield, California we go. Chase, welcome to the show. Hey, Chase.
Hey, George, how are you today?
Good.
Good, good. I got two questions. I'll only ask one because you need to get other people on. I believe in extraterrestrial seeding of planet Earth. I don't necessarily believe in God, and I don't necessarily not believe in him. But my theory is, what if we were seeded here from another colony out in another part of the universe or another galaxy?
Well, you know, if we were seeded, then it depends on the level of seeding. What, are we talking about starting from microorganisms, or are we starting from something higher? Understand that when we explore all the life on Earth, we find a common thread throughout genetics so that everything is related. So we're very certain that all of the organisms we see on the Earth in our everyday affairs come from some common stock at some point in the past. If we were seeded from somewhere else, then they would have to transport an entire environment here to match what we live in.
Oh, yeah. Well, I get what you're saying right there. I understand that. I wasn't clear. I'm sorry. When I mean seeded by everybody, every living creature, every living organism here, like from another planet, like let's say Mars, you guys are talking about Mars tonight. What if billions and billions of years ago, Mars and Earth were the same thing, and the aliens came and fixed up Earth because it's close to the sun?
Sure. Well, you know, that is a theory, Chase. That's a theory of Zachariah Sitchin. That beings came here from another planet that he claims is in the solar system and genetically altered what was already on this planet and turned them into us.
Yeah.
That's a great theory.
You know, I guess I'm sort of the odd man out on a lot of those theories. I just believe in plain old aliens.
Are you familiar at all with Zachariah Sitchin's work? Charles?
I've heard the name. I haven't looked at his work at all.
Okay.
But, you know, the least hypothesis is life is common and it's everywhere.
I think so, too. Absolutely. The big question, of course, for me, and I'm sure you have probably tried to ponder this, too, is what the heck are we? What is the life? Why?
It's because reality organizes itself. If you take random numbers in a computer, they eventually come together to organization under any system of operation. Order comes from chaos automatically. It's just within the nature of our universe and possibly any other universe. So when we have something as complicated as molecules, they're going to organize themselves automatically, taken with just a little bit of energy and a little bit of water. We know that organization can lead to life. And so it isn't surprising. It shouldn't be surprising.
Okay, next up, let's go to Bloomington, Illinois, where Bill is waiting on the line. Hey, Bill.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. This is very interesting. My question is, some civilizations, their junk is another civilization's treasure. Now, if we assume that there's life that is more advanced than us that are visiting our planet, when you have Mars, Jupiter, Venus, and all the planets that we know of, if there was any importance at all to the universe or to them, why haven't they either colonized it or left something there? And why do they feel that Earth is more important or valued than any of those other planets?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, a lot of people don't look into that. We're often told aliens would come looking for food or water, and that's not correct. There's more water out in the universe for free than anybody would ever need. But consider that aliens with the ability to travel from solar system to solar system also have the resources of those other solar systems at their disposal. We're just one of hundreds of billions of stars in this galaxy, and so there are resources everywhere. It probably is that there is so much out there for the taking that it's not worth it.
Okay, thanks, Bill. Next, Bill is gone. East of the Rockies. Mike, your turn. Thanks, Mike.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. Excellent show, by the way. A couple of callers ago, they were talking about the moon race between us and the Soviets. What would have happened, do you think, if during the Apollo 12 mission, before it happened, we would have called the Russian and said, hey, send us one of your astronauts. I don't think that's what they were called, but let him train with us for a couple of months, and we'll go to the moon together with Apollo 12. Do you think that would have kept us? Would we still be on the moon, maybe? We could have. How do you think that would have turned out?
I'm not really certain, and one of the reasons is issues of national security. We were very loath to share a lot of information with the Soviet Union at that time, and, of course, they were not very happy about sharing a lot of information with us. And it isn't from the scientist standpoint, but from the political standpoint. When we meet with scientists from Russia, and in decades past when American scientists and Soviet scientists met, they were often quite willing to share information because each of them had a slightly different angle on things, a different take. And so sending Russians to the moon on our spacecraft would have been impractical for reasons of national security, because governments generally are very stingy with their information. Would we have remained if we had done it? Perhaps so, but it would have required an entirely different mindset than was in place at that time.
Right. Well, what do you think about instead of going to the moon, we go right to Mars? So we don't, we're going to have to spend a lot of money to learn how to deal with this lunar dust. We got to get the water, if there's any up there, ice out of the soil. We could save a lot of money, just head right toward Mars.
Well, this is also another very important consideration. Mars has resources that we wouldn't need to ship there. But one of the issues here is that existing spacecraft would take from 7 to 10 months to get people there. So you're talking about sending an immense fleet of hardware just to support people and keep them alive. And the smart thing to do would be to send some modules in advance that would land, set themselves up, and be ready for occupation. And they could be producing fuel and water as the people are arriving. And the other issue is, if you spend 7 to 10 months traveling in space, you generally aren't going to have radiation shielding, and you'll probably find that the return trip would be fatal. So anybody we send to Mars using our existing technology is probably there for the duration.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. You're welcome. Mike, east of the Rockies. Hey, Mike, thank you for calling.
You bet.
Okay, next up, Alan, Baltimore.
Yeah. Hello?
Yeah, yes. Go ahead, Alan.
Oh, am I on?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hello. I'd like to ask one or two questions, but very quickly. In the beginning of the show, you made reference to someone who had a rechargeable automobile that they were they had a prototype out. Hello?
Anything that I've really
Not Sir Charles.
No.
I talked about a solar car earlier.
Yeah, this is just a footnote to the main reason I'm calling. Could I encourage you in the future to possibly use the phraseology alleged when you're referring to climate change and global warming?
Well, I don't believe in global warming.
Exactly. Neither do I. Anyway.
That's why I said they say.
Oh, I didn't hear that in the beginning because I'm a little ahead of you on different time zones. I've been trying to stay awake. I've been sort of fighting the Sandman
tonight.
But anyway, would it do any good to use the Hubble telescope? Would it pick up anything, or would it not see through the atmosphere of Mars? I've never heard anybody discuss that.
Actually, it sees through the atmosphere quite clearly, and the Hubble has revealed something fascinating within the last couple of years. When light passes through clouds that are made of water, it either does one of two things. It either polarizes the light or it does not. And Hubble, looking at the clouds in the Martian atmosphere, found that roughly half of them polarize the light. What this means is they're made of water droplets and not ice crystals. So half of the clouds, apparently, in the atmosphere of Mars, as seen by Hubble, appear to be liquid water droplets and not ice crystals. And that's a fascinating result from Hubble.
I see. Did you also say that I assume you have studied some of the images coming back from Mars, right? Independently.
Oh, yes.
Did you say that you had seen indirect evidence of, I hope I'm not sounding silly, but I thought you had said fossils, or that indirectly you were jumping to a conclusion that there may be fossils based on something else that you had seen in images?
Oh, absolutely. I've got pictures of fossils, no doubt about it. And you can look at the website.
Yeah, I've got to get that computer.
And you can see the images. There are objects of very unusual shape and repetitive structure all over the planet. And you can't imagine that geology would simply erode thousands or millions of identical rocks into exactly the same form. Some other agency has to be responsible, and biology is the simplest and most direct answer.
I see. But, again, about Hubble, can Hubble pick up details as far as the surface, or is that's not possible?
Oh, no, not at all. It's just a large globe to them.
So it's seeing the water molecules in the atmosphere.
That's correct.
I mean, or it's seeing evidence of it as opposed to crystals.
That's right. There are both crystals and liquid droplets in the atmosphere at this time.
I see. Both of them actually exist. But Hubble is picking up both or just the...
It's seeing both, and it can tell them apart because of the polarization of light.
The polarization. Very interesting. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You are very welcome. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, David, go ahead.
Yeah, I was talking with your caller guy there and telling him that I was so impressed with tonight's program, the whole program. What would you think about the idea of someone who has an in with the very top, the president-elect, to get a recording of this whole program to him so that perhaps in the future sometime he could break up that logjam of information with NASA?
Well, I think that would be a positive step, and, of course, I'm open to speak with or meet with just about anybody.
But maybe just, you know, instead of a meeting that might be hard to get into his office, just someone present a recording of tonight's program, which in its entirety was so eye-opening.
Well, you know, when I look at the hits on my website, there are certain days when between 40 and 90% of my hits come from government and science agencies.
Yes. They do monitor,
they
Charles. Yep, they're there. They're listening in Washington. We're on WMAL up there. They're listening. I'm sure they're probably Streamlink members recording the show right now. Let's go west of the Rockies, Rob in Modesto, California. Hey, Rob, go ahead.
Hi, guys. Good evening. I'm glad I got through.
Good.
I wanted to bring up that I've been involved with Sylvia Brown's spiritual group for many years, and I've never heard anybody mention about her. And I'm kind of curious why, because she's a psychic and she has a lot of insight and information. And one of the things that she has mentioned in her spiritual books that I purchased is that she says that the other planets were in alignment as the same rotation around the Earth, around the sun as Earth is right now. And that explains a lot of the other life forms that we've found on other planets.
You used to have her on as a guest, Rob, quite a bit.
Oh, did you?
And after she kind of... missed the situation in that miners' tragedy where 12 to 13 miners died.
Uh-huh.
I haven't had her back yet. But,
okay.
Yeah, but she used to be on quite a bit.
Okay.
Well, and one of the other considerations is I try to stick with verifiable scientific resources, and I don't try to foray into other areas that I'm not familiar with. I try to stick strictly with information that we can measure and touch and see, and other people can see for themselves. And that's sometimes a little difficult to do when you're dealing with somebody such as a psychic.
So, Charles, take a moment, give us your website, spell it, and tell us about A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars.
Okay, the website is xenotechresearch.com, xenotechresearch, or you can just go online and search for Mars Fossils and Sir Charles, and you'll be able to find the site. And the book, The Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars, is just about 400 pages, many illustrations, fully referenced, and it explains exactly what I found on Mars and how I reached my conclusions, and it also covers the issues of why NASA is avoiding the facts and doesn't seem to be very happy with finding or announcing life. And I recommend it highly. Of course, I wrote it myself, so I'm going to be biased.
Pictures are in the book?
Absolutely. In fact, I also include a set of anaglyph glasses because many of the images are in 3D, and much of the information you can't see unless you see it in 3D.
Just like the old days, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Charles, where do we go in the future? What's up? What's next?
Well, I'm hoping that at some point somebody's going to break down and say, you know, we really need to look at this information. They need to recognize that these are anomalies. And it isn't going to be harmful to people to know that there's alien life. I mean, from somebody else's perspective, we're alien life. So what does it hurt for people to know the facts? Where do we go? I hope that somebody will assign somebody to
address this issue head on. Let's get that rover aimed at some of these anomalies. Let's get the images back. We can do that. It's within our grasp. So it wouldn't take very much, simply a decision on somebody's part to say, hey, this is mystifying us. Let's look at it. Let's find out what it is.
Well, you know what? If they come out and say that there is life up there, they're probably afraid that their futuristic rovers that are going to dig and test for life probably won't get funded. It's a possibility, Charles.
Well, it's a possibility, but I would think that it would be actually better to design more in-depth and comprehensive hardware and to send a fleet of small duplicate rovers.
I agree. Thank you, Sir Charles. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Landesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.